and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm host Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Listen, we had a lot of fun a couple weeks ago as we returned to the OK Corral for True Crime Tuesday. And a lot of people loved that episode, said they liked the change up and talking about different aspects of history and some famous names that have unbelievable legends attached to them. Getting to the bottom of this, and I teased that there was a book out that I just saw and was very interested in talking about on True Crime Tuesday. And all I said was it was about the mysterious life of Jesse James. And I got to tell you, I got a lot of emails saying, when are you guys going to do the Jesse James episode? So that excites me that people are paying attention, that they like that we go off the beaten path and we don't need necessarily serial killers every week or twisted romance gone wrong. We can talk about these amazing stories from our history. Yeah, so absolutely. The new book is called The Mysterious Life and Faked Death of Jesse James, based on family records, forensic evidence, and his personal journals. Joining us today, two actual family members of Jesse James, Daniel Duke and Teresa Duke, are here with us. The book is out and available. We have a link to that book on today's program, so make sure you get that book. And rate and review the books as well, folks. I know we ask this all the time, but it is an important part of helping the authors get their books recognized on places like Amazon or wherever you may purchase your books. But take just a few seconds to rate and review and spread the word on these style books. So welcome to the show, Teresa Duke. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. Yes, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
And Daniel, again, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having us. I'm also honored to be here.
All right. So, Daniel, clarify this. He's your great, 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 great grandfather. How exactly do you guys fit in the picture with relations to Jesse James?
All right. Jesse was our great, great grandfather.
Just two. Okay, great. Boy, that sounds strange. It feels like Jesse James was like a million years ago, right? But you're really not that far removed from that point in history.
Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
Yeah, it's a lot closer than, well, you'll find, it's a lot closer than most people would think.
I guess. Now, Teresa, talk to me. How old were you when the story and legend of Jesse James is introduced to you and that, well, you're a descendant?
Oh, gosh. Ever since I can remember as a kid, probably, well, my entire life, basically, but when it finally kind of dawned on me actually who Jesse James was, I was probably around 10 or 11. And I always heard the stories my mom would tell me. I would always tell my friends at school back in the day. So yeah, probably like just my entire life. And it's just something that we always heard that was passed down to us.
And Daniel, do you remember, you know, getting that realization that Jesse James is your relative?
Yeah, it was, you know, I heard it growing up, but I was real small, I didn't know who he was. And then later, you know, as you get older, especially in my teen years, you know, a lot of the relatives and especially my mother kept kind of played it down. She was worried that my brother and I would run off and do something stupid. And back in those days, we probably would have. So, you know, trying to emulate our ancestor or something. But yeah, when it finally dawned on me, it was really, it was just a strange realization that, yeah, he actually was.
What is it? I've got to ask, you know, my introduction, and I don't know, Tim, I don't know if this was yours as well, but you and I are that same age range. I got to be honest, my introduction to Jesse James, but, well, I'll throw it out to you, Daniel and Teresa. What do you think was my first introduction to the character that was Jesse James?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm not really sure. Probably maybe a movie. You saw a movie with Jesse James in it?
It's the most unlikely scenario on planet Earth, but Jesse James was introduced to me via the Brady Bunch.
Oh, you know, I saw that episode.
Now, that was for any of you in my age range or you know, that you raised your kids on good TV with Brady Bunch as well. There's an episode where I think Bobby becomes fascinated with Jesse James and
yes.
wants to emulate him. And And they end up, if I remember correctly, they end up introducing him to some old gentleman who was like a kid on a train that Jesse James robbed, reportedly, and kind of opens Bobby's eyes to what a cold-blooded, ruthless killer. And this is nobody to emulate. This is nobody to think of as a hero. And right. And that was my first honest indoctrination to Jesse James. And at first, being a TV show, I had a hard time. I got to be honest with you. I had a hard time as a kid and even as a teenager realizing that Jesse James then was actually a real person and not just some character they created for the Brady Bunch. But with that said, and so that you understand just how stupid the host of the show is that you're speaking to, I then one summer was caddying at Medina Golf Course and was told to bring a football. So I brought a football one day because a guy was signing footballs, and we all stood there waiting, and the guy signed our footballs and he started to walk off, and one of the other kids ran up and had missed his chance. And he goes, "Oh, I wanted an autograph so bad." And I said, "Here, you can have mine. It's just the guy from the Brady Bunch." And it was Joe Namath. Oh. I wasn't a football fan at that point, had no clue who Joe Namath was, and tossed away my Joe Namath autograph because he was the guy that showed up on the Brady Bunch. So that shows you.
Oh my God.
So, kind of out of tune I was with reality. But then once I learned about Jesse James and realized who this character was, I kind of fell in love with the Wild West, and I loved to look and read and examine stories of Billy the Kid and the Regulators and Butch and Sundance and any of these kind of Wild West anti-heroes, if you would. But how strange that they were treated with such reverence and terror at the same time. But it seemed everything I picked up would tell me different aspects of Jesse James' life that seemed to contradict everything else I'd read. So I'm glad we're able to come together and talk about this. So let's examine the case and the history of Jesse James. And I don't know which one of you would like to start. So maybe I'll throw to you first, Teresa. Jesse James, what was his life like growing up, and where did he grow up?
He grew up in Kearney, Missouri. It was a relatively simple life growing up. He was a farmer. His family was a farmer. So it was basically just, you know, like a simple life of farming and, you know, and then I think it was just that that's kind of where the war just kind of changed his path in life. Who knows why he would have been if he hadn't become a guerrilla.
Well, talk to me about that. I mean, was he a rabble rouser growing up, a problem child, or did he just get restless and, you know, decide to strike out at an early age and started just making bad choice after bad choice?
I think it started with the war, the Civil War at the time, and he from my understanding, he wasn't a problem child. He was a normal boy growing up with his family and doing normal kid things. His dad was a Baptist preacher. They were, you know, farmers as well. Just a normal family, and I think the war, from what we gathered from historical reports, his family was, when the war started, the border wars, there was a lot of abuse going on, and people coming in, soldiers coming in and abusing their families. And I think that's kind of what, you know, it changed the course of his life. And he saw his mother abused. He saw his stepfather abused. And I think that it changed the course of his life and set him in a whole new direction, from a farmer to becoming an outlaw and robbing banks and, you know, just doing things that a normal person normally wouldn't do, but they weren't living in normal circumstances back then.
Did with this lifestyle and watching how his family was treated, do you believe that his hand was kind of forced into these moments of feeling like all he had left was crime in order to try to make their lives better? Or was this not so valor filled? You know, this was just selfish self-preservation.
I honestly think that he was forced into it. That's my personal opinion. Just from what we've read on historical records, they set out. It was kind of like when they formed this group. It was the guerrillas that formed a group to strike back and get revenge on the soldiers that were abusing their families. They decided to take action in their own hands. So I personally think it was just kind of forced on them. And it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know what I would do in that time, but I know that I wouldn't stand to see my family getting abused. I would want to strike back and take matters in my own hand and get out there and do what I could do to protect my family and my community. And I think that was the driving force at the beginning. I think they wanted to form a group to protect their community, their family. They saw horrible atrocities back then. So I personally think they were forced into it. And then it just got to the point where they couldn't come back. They were so far into it. And they did try. You know, there were circumstances. There was a story where Jesse James was trying to surrender, and he got shot in the lungs, and he almost died. So they did try to surrender, and they tried to start their life anew, but fate wouldn't have it. I think fate led them down a completely different destiny for their life.
So then, Daniel, when Jesse James starts this legendary change in his life, is he solo? Is he running with a pack, with friends, relatives? What is his life like at that point?
All right. Well, you know, as Teresa had mentioned, he tried to turn himself in at the end of the Civil War. He was a Confederate guerrilla, and none of the guerrillas were granted amnesty like the Confederate soldiers were, you know, of the regular Confederate Army. And he tried to turn himself in. He got shot through his lung and somehow escaped and lived. And while he was healing, the other guerrillas, you know, he had to heal while in hiding. And the other guerrillas that he had fought with during the war were all they were all on the run, too. Back then, you know, they weren't granted amnesty. If they turned themselves in, they were quickly executed. And it was, if you've ever seen the movie The Outlaw Josie Wales, that their story was a lot like that, you know, with the fighting that went on during the war, before the war, and afterwards. And they were hunted like dogs, basically. So they didn't have much choice. It was either leave the country or stay and fight. And I believe they chose to stay and fight. And you know, if they couldn't make a living because they were being hunted, like they were branded outlaws, they had to, you know, a few of them banded together. Jesse, Frank, Cole Younger and his brothers. So it was the James Younger gang and several of the other guerrillas they knew. And they started robbing banks. They hit the Liberty Bank in Missouri. And that's where... I can't remember the man's first name for some reason off the top of my head, but his last name was Wymore. It was a 17-year-old boy. That's where he was killed during
Jack.
That robbery. Yeah, Jack Wymore.
Now, when you see the stories coming out about your great-great-grandfather and that he ended up cutting kind of a bloody swatch that had nothing to do with his work in the, you know, as a guerrilla, but his work as an outlaw, how easy is it to really kind of cut through the BS and look at history and see what he legitimately did as opposed to what salacious headline grabbing newspapers of the time would post and attribute to him, even though he might not have had anything to do with?
It's not very easy at all. There was so much written as history in those days, and even today. I mean, there's a lot that's written as fact that isn't really verifiable. There's a lot of things, especially in the newspapers, Well, news and books. And, you know, there was a lot. People claimed he murdered so-and-so and he murdered different people, but there was never any real proof. And he was never brought to, you know, he was never caught. So they couldn't hold, you know, have a trial and examine it really in a court of law. So everything was pretty much hearsay in a lot of cases. And I know he was no angel. I'm not defending him. He was no angel, but in our opinion, a lot of the guys back in those days were kind of forced into that life. So in a way, I mean, nobody forced them, but they didn't have much of a choice. And I'm sure he killed people. I just don't know an exact number, and I would like to know the exact number.
Do you believe that those were instances of him being an outlaw or him killing to protect himself? I understand that that's probably a very razor thin line, because every mm-hmm. outlaw feels that what they did was to justify their own life and to keep them moving. But I mean that, you know, you had a lot of people that were out trying to collect bounties. You had a lot of people that would draw first and make assumptions or do stupid things. And, you know, some of these guys ended up building a legend on the fact that really they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Somebody picked a fight with them and they ended up losing. And that made, you know, Jesse James look like this ravenous murderer when really he was protecting his own life at that point.
Exactly.
There were cases where, well, like the Pinkerton, one of the Pinkerton detectives, Pinkerton Detective Agency had chased them for a long time. And one of the guys was found. He was looking for him. He was going up. He stopped at a roadside inn and he was kind of bragging about, you know, he was going to catch the James gang. And somebody, you know, the guy who owned the inn was a former sheriff who was also related to Jesse and Frank. And the next day he was the only guy in there at the time. He heard the Pinkerton detective talking about it. And I don't know if the sheriff killed the Pinkerton detective or if the James gang did, but the next day he was found dead on the side of the road, the Pinkerton detective. So I don't know if Jesse did it or if one of the gang did it. And of course, you know, in a lot of those cases, I think it just got automatically attributed to Jesse. Because, you know, anytime they would rob a bank, it was usually Jesse. Well, you know, they called him the leader, so he was responsible. So I would imagine anytime they murdered somebody, the same thing would happen. It would get tacked onto Jesse. But yeah, it's self-defense. It's kind of, it may have been in a lot of cases, but in other cases, it may have just been to protect his identity or his anonymity. So
right. Yeah. Right. Now, what crimes do we know? What famous crimes can we actually attribute to him? Was he the gentleman robber that they made him seem out to be, that he was kind of this robbing from the rich to give to the poor, you know, trying to just equalize the sides? Was there any fact in that, or is that just part of good legends and Pete Seeger songs?
There were he was attributed a lot of the robberies he was involved with. But I do, we all, both Teresa and I, the whole family thinks that he wasn't guilty of all the robberies, but the gang itself was. They would, just like in the Civil War, when they were riding as guerrillas, they would split up and hit different targets simultaneously. And, you know, just like a military action. And that's exactly how they ran the gang. It was like, it's almost like the war never ended for them. It wasn't allowed to. So they were in a way continuing the war, and they applied guerrilla tactics. So you would have two robberies 100 miles apart, and both would be attributed to the gang, the James gang, on the same morning or same day, and sometimes further apart. And I think, well, we found out over the years that his cousin Wood Height, who bore a strong resemblance to Jesse, had also, he would lead other factions of the gang at times, and they would hit places at the same time. I hope I answered your question. I'll start getting off on a different trip.
You did, but I also want to bring back something. When any one of these old time movies show up and they talk about the Pinkertons, they create the Pinkertons to be something legendary, like the Texas Rangers, like these stand up, amazing detectives whose job it was to clear the ruffians. And they were really kind of the guerrillas of their own time. And they were sloppy, they were messy. Am I misunderstanding that? Because it seems like they get a really good reputation, and they were worse than most of the outlaws.
They were.
Exactly.
They were very rough. In fact, Alan Pinkerton, the head of the agency, was a criminal in the UK, in Scotland, before he came to America. And then, you know, he was a criminal in Scotland. He came to America, and during the Civil War, he guarded, you know, high level people, even the president at times. But they had been accused of, you know, they would bomb miners who were striking. And, you know, before and after Jesse, there were several accounts where they would bomb miners, you know, throw dynamite in a hole, mow them down, all kinds of things. And then they did the same thing to criminals or any outlaws. They played real dirty. And with Jesse and his family, they threw a bomb into Jesse's mother's home. It killed his 9-year-old brother, blew his mother's arm off, and maimed his stepfather's hand. And actually, right. That was the point. That was one of the major turning points in public support for the James Gang, because, you know, it was just a low down dirty thing they did. And that's how the whole country saw it. So and it it got a lot of support it was a great PR move for the James Gang, even though it wasn't their, you know, they didn't want to do it that way.
Well, you see this kind of thing happening, and this does suddenly make him the Hollywood legendary character, right? He becomes the reluctant hero of his own story. Now, from the outside, it's easy to look at him being this outlaw. But when you start looking and analyzing, and I understand, folks, before you write in, well, Dave, you do realize that Daniel and Teresa are his relatives. So, of course, they're going to try to make him seem more like the victim. But in actually reading the history before even touching their book, you can see these points of how sometimes people are pushed into situations where bad choices to the rest of us are the only choice they have left. And until you're put in these moments of self-preservation.
Exactly.
And feeling like your family and everybody that you love and care for is under attack, if you don't stand up and take what's yours, it's a very weird kind of dichotomy.
Exactly. Right. You never know till you're put in that position.
He does some of these crimes. What about train robberies? Is this something that he legitimately was a part of, and was this on a regular basis, or were these part of the hyped up imaginings of, you know, hey, we got held up. Jesse James group was seen in the area recently. It must be them, and things attributed to him.
Oh yeah. They had robbed plenty of trains, and he was involved with quite a few of the train robberies, stages, trains, and banks. You know, there were like some of the notable ones you had mentioned earlier, like the Ockerbock Bank in Iowa was one of the earlier ones that he had robbed. And after he had robbed that one, they split up and he came to Texas. But that one was one of the strangest robberies, in my opinion, that after studying all the details from it, because I liked trying to find out not only, you know, about Jesse and how they robbed these banks, but who owned the bank and do their genealogy or check, you know, anything I could find on them, an old newspaper reports like the Ockerbock brothers, the whole deal behind that. I believe, but there's no fact, of course, this is just a theory, that the Ockerbock brothers were the only ones in that small town in Corydon, Iowa at the time who weren't supporting the development of a new railroad that was to come through. Well, the morning of the robbery, Henry Clay Dean, who was known as a famous copperhead, he was a Democrat. They called him a copperhead Democrat. Peace during the war, they wanted peace, you know, even though they sided with the North, they wanted peace between the two sides. But he also sympathized with the Confederates, and he was a well-known orator and politician. Mark Twain had written about him. They called him a filthy man. He was very unkempt, but he was one of the best speakers in the country. And in those days, people would come from 50 miles around just to hear him give a speech. Well, he was in favor of this railroad coming through. So the morning of the robbery, he's on one end of the town. And his speech had been advertised for weeks, probably. So people came from miles around. And the entire town was on the other side of town from the bank. And the bankers, of course, were the only ones in town who didn't want to give money for the railroad. Well, Jesse and them, it made it real easy. And it almost made me wonder if Henry Clay Dean hadn't worked out a deal with the James brothers. I'll pull people over to this side of the town while you guys ride into the other side and take out the bank, and there won't be anyone around to watch it happen or to prevent it. And so they waltzed in, robbed the bank, and they had so much time when they were leaving the Corydon. They rode past the crowd and the speech and interrupted it and told everybody the bank just got robbed. And everybody was shushing them, telling them, they were trying to hear the speech. And they rode on, and, it was too late. By the time the posse got formed, they were long gone. And it was just interesting little aspects like that that always made me curious. And also in Northfield, Minnesota, the bank robbery that was supposed to be one of the, the
right. This is our backyard. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, the end of the James gang. We don't believe Jesse was at that one. We believe it was Wood Height. We believe Frank was there, but Jesse wasn't. Wood Height, Jesse's cousin, was there, and he led that robbery, and it failed. But if you check out the guys who owned the bank and the shareholders in the Northfield, Minnesota bank, there's ties back to the Pinkertons and other people, which made me wonder if that's why they targeted the bank. It wasn't just, a rich bank up north in some area. And they hadn't been in that far north before, but it wasn't just a random target. I don't believe. I believe they had a lot of wartime animosities and also ties with the Pinkertons. That was a great target for them to want to hit, hit them back where it hurt.
Now Jesse James, of course, Frank James, very popular as well. But you hear of the James gang, you hear the name James. The first one to leap to mind is Jesse. Why is Jesse the more prominent of these two brothers?
That's a good question. Frank was he wasn't as outgoing as Jesse. He was real serious. He was deadly himself, but he was more low-key and not quite as outgoing. And I think that was one that may have been the reason Jesse was pegged as, it was his gang. He did a lot of the planning, and that could be another reason. Maybe I have a feeling the whole gang kind of looked at Jesse as the guy who did the planning, but they all seemed to be fairly equal in their skills as gunmen. So, and horse riding, some of the Cole Younger and Frank were both older than Jesse, but they followed his lead.
I think Jesse was also more, just from what we've read in historical accounts, during his guerrilla days, he was more daring and bold than Frank. I think yeah. Frank was the more studious, Frank was more serious and kind of held back. And I think Jesse, from what we read, just accounts, he was the go-getter, the risk taker. There were stories of him, going head on, riding his horse at a fast gallop with, two pistols in his hands, the horse reins in his mouth, grand, bold stories like that. And I think that's why he stood out more. He was more reckless and daring.
Amazing stuff.
And
again, the stuff of true legends, because, history, his story, it's the one, the most recognizable, the most famous and daring do of these people that get covered. And in most cases of telephone game, it gets bigger, right? I mean, somebody might have bumped into Jesse James in a bar and politely nodded, but when they get home, oh my God, today I had a standoff with Jesse James in the bar. We bumped into each other, our eyes narrowed as I reached slowly for my gun and he reached for his. And then I said, can we just end this here? And Jesse James dropped his head and walked away. That's the way these stories blew up.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And he did have, there was a guy by the name of John Newman Edwards, who I think kind of helped bring their life into these legendary figures that they are today. He was a journalist, and he would write stories on the James Gang. And I think he has a lot to do with their legendary status today.
Yeah, he did. John Newman Edwards always wrote of Jesse and the gang as they were the poor, misfortunate victims. And, the law was out to get them and destroy them. And that was how he pretty much he kept at that over the years. And then when the Pinkertons blew up his mother's house, that his writing seemed to get even more attention because, it almost justified everything he'd been saying all those years before, even though they weren't always the victims, but I guess they were victims of their circumstances, and every war is going to have losers. They were on the side that lost, and they were hunted like animals, and that all the PR that John Newman Edwards had printed before that just came to the whole country bought it, or half the country bought it anyway, when the Pinkertons blew up their home. So that kind of got a lot of people behind on the bandwagon that they're poor victims. But, they didn't really have that much on them even then, because Frank James, after 1882 had been held. They had trials for Frank, and he was acquitted. He was never convicted as a murderer, and they couldn't really pin anything on him.
Would he help himself and push a lot of these things onto Jesse, though? Would that also help add to the legend? Frank was acquitted because he turned on his brother and said, hey, Jesse's the trigger guy. Jesse was the one in charge. Jesse led our group.
Some people could have been led to believe that, but Frank never said it. So, he just kept quiet the whole time. He had a lot of powerful supporters in his day. General Joe Shelby got kicked out of the courtroom because he was drunk and he threatened to kill the prosecutor. So it was, these upstanding men were in his defense, and Frank really never said much. Everybody else did the talking for him except for when he was on the stand. But he never pointed the finger at anybody or at Jesse for sure.
How did Frank get caught, but Jesse managed to keep eluding the law?
Frank had turned himself in, and this was after the alleged assassination in 1882 of Jesse.
Now, were there close calls, or were there moments like Billy the Kid's Legends or Butch and Sundance where they would eventually get Jesse, but he would find, he'd crawl out of a jail window or seduce the warden's daughter and she'd let him out? I mean, are there any stories along that way, or was this guy just that proficient and kind of military strategic that he was always able to stay one foot ahead of the law?
He never got arrested. He had never been caught. No one captured him, and he never turned himself in. He was that good at it. And they went for over 15 years running from the law after the Civil War. So he dodged the Union forces during the war, and afterwards he was dodging the law for up until 1882, when they allegedly killed him.
When they allegedly, and we're going to get into that in a few minutes here. It's really a shame because you realize he was proficient as a guerrilla warrior during the war, right? He was proficient at creating tactical strikes to get things done, to cause chaos and illusion and keep people distracted over here while he's committing a crime over here, which actually is very smart because that limited the amount of victims or casualties that would have happened. This guy, if they would have just marshaled him in and forgiven him and asked him or given him a position in the military and paid him, what an amazing leader James could have been at some point.
And I like how you use the word illusion. I really feel like their success, I contribute it to they became illusionists. They it was like smoke and mirrors that they were creating. They were constantly, you know, I think they stayed ahead of the game by switching up their, they would dye their hair. They would, you know, change up their appearance, lots of disguises. And I think that was kind of what contributed to the success of the longevity of their adventures. I like to call it adventures.
Now, do you ever speak to the family of victims of Jesse James? And, you know, I mean, obviously in your ideas, it's an adventure to them. They, you know, their family members encountered a bloodthirsty murderer. What do other people say about the survivors of his crimes?
That's a good question. I have never, I've never spoken to a victim of the, you know, the relatives of the victims, but it would be interesting. I would definitely like to hear their viewpoint.
We'd had a couple of emails. Our late mother had a few emails from people, and they would, it was, I guess they just felt the need to email her and say, you know, your dirty relative killed my ancestor. So, you know, it's hard to really know what to say to people when they, you know, when you meet them. We never met them in person, but every once in a while there's an email, and you never even knew if we never really knew if it was just a prank or if it was really somebody wanting to say that. We never apologized for it because we didn't know if it was true or not, you know. And they never really gave. It was just people. Somebody would send an email and say, you know, your ancestor killed my ancestor. And, you know, that was a rotten thing to do. And they never even gave names.
Gotcha. Understandable. Yeah. Well, you know, were there some harsh realizations for the two of you as you were gathering this information and going through these journals, looking at this? I mean, you know, there's certain elements where we can say this was a misunderstood kid who was put in a bad position and made the best of his life that he could, but he still murdered. He still was a criminal. Were there points where you had to face that? And what was that like for you?
My mindset is it's wartime. In war, I just think that it brings out the, it's war. I mean, everything's off limits during that time. It's sad that that all had to happen, that they, you know, that even took place. But in my mind, it was war, and they did what they did to survive and protect their families.
Now, as he's going forward, at what age did he become a gorilla?
I think it was around 16, right, Danny?
Oh, he was 14. Well, when he started searching for someone to take, he was 14 years old when a guerrilla group from Kansas rode onto their farm and strapped him to a plow, beat him severely, rode onto to his farmhouse where his mother and stepfather were. And the accounts vary on what happened to her. She was pregnant at the time. Some say they stripped her and tied her to a tree and whipped her. While others say they just pushed her around, but they hung his stepfather over and over until he was brain damaged. You know, he was lucky to live, I guess, but he was permanently brain damaged, his stepfather. And Jesse wanted revenge, so he went out looking. He tried to join the Confederacy. They wouldn't take him because he was too young, and he finally found Quantrell's guerrillas, and they took him in and let him fight. And that was when his whole story really kind of took off.
So he's 14 when he strikes out. At what point did he start really full on into the life of kind of crime and adventures to keep himself alive?
He was still a teenager. He was around 17 to 18 years old when he was robbing his first bank. And his brother was, you know, not early 20s. And Cole Younger, I believe, may have been, they were all in their, either their teens or early 20s, the entire gang at the beginning.
All right. So that's his age going into the quote unquote military, the guerrillas. That's his age going into this life of crime. How long is his reign as the famous Jesse James?
As an outlaw, as the famous Jesse James, it was about 16 years.
15 that's really amazing when you consider the times and his high profile, that he was out there for 15 to 16 years as this criminal on the run, that somebody didn't gun him down. Was that because people held him in reverence? Was he kind of painted as this Robin Hood of the West, and people felt sorry for him, or people were just so afraid of him, or he was just that good at getting in and out that nobody even knew he was there until after the crime had been committed?
I think it was all of the above. In the area where he grew up, you know, he had a lot of relatives, and they'd all fought on the same side. They'd all gone through the same hardships, and they, you know, he was one of them. So he had a buffer in his area, kind of like some of the mob stories you'd hear about, you know, some just different mafia characters throughout our more recent history. They usually had a little buffer of supporters, and that helped to insulate them. But in other parts of the country, you know, he relied on his skill. He didn't go to bars and saloons like a lot of outlaws did. He always steered clear of that, which also I'm sure helped, you know, helped his longevity or helped his career. There was just a lot of different things. People were afraid of him. And like one of their neighbors actually hated their guts and was spying on them for the Pinkertons for a while. And after the bombing, and which led to the bombing of his mother's house and the death of his brother, and they killed that neighbor. I mean, I don't know if it was Jesse. It was probably Jesse and Frank both rode onto the neighbor's farm and killed him. But, you know, so there was fear of retaliation if you did spy for the law against them, you know, different thing. If you turned them in, you'd probably die there. And it wasn't just Jesse and Frank. Somebody in the entire gang would have probably got them back. So, yeah, I'd say it was all of the above.
Once he has made his way through this kind of life of violence and being on the run, you know, and I got to ask too, personally, I mean, is he able to find happiness while he's out there? Does he find love? Does he find anything that's kind of a semblance of normality? Or is it always just riding off into the dark, always hiding in caves, you know, avoiding law at all chances? What is his life really like?
He found love. He married, after the Corydon, Iowa robbery in 1871, they rode west into Nebraska. The gang split up and a lot of them stuck together until they got to Fort Worth, and then they split up, and he went to Fort Worth knowing, he met his future father-in-law just outside of Fort Worth. Later that year in October, on Halloween, he married his wife, who was Mary Ellen Barron, which is, you know, that's where another place history has it wrong. They claimed he married Z. Mims, his first cousin. And we believe that was Wood Height that married Z. Mims, not Jesse, because Jesse rode into Texas, met Thomas Hudson Barron, who was a former captain of the Texas Rangers. And they rode together for a way, split up, and then they met again at Barron's Ranch south of Waco. And a few months later, he married Barron's daughter, Mary Ellen. And that was in 1871, right, Teresa?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. For some reason, 1872 always sticks in my head, and this time I got it right. So,
how is he able to have any kind of normal life? I mean, the world knows who Jesse James is. His stories were printed across the sea in England, and people talked about this nefarious criminal. How could he have any kind of private life?
That's a good question, and it seemed like, especially in these days, I think it would be impossible. In those days, the only people who really knew his true identity, you know, his or how to describe how he looked, were his gang, you know, his fellow gang members and relatives and his friends. And his friends and relatives were all either part of the gang or lived right near him. A lot of Quantrell's guerrillas after the war came to Texas and lived south of Waco and in different places. But there was a large group of them that lived south of Waco where he ended up moving. And you know, he married his wife, Mary Ellen. So not many, the law didn't have a, the Pinkertons or any other law enforcement had no accurate descriptions of what Jesse actually looked like. They ranged from, you know, being 5'8" to over 6 foot tall. And nobody, you know, they didn't know how tall or short he was. They didn't really know what color his hair was. Sometimes it looked dark. Other times it was sandy, like a strawberry blonde. So nobody really knew. And that helped him a great deal.
So was he using many different aliases wherever he was? And did your great-great-grandmother know that she was with the Jesse James? Or was he hiding that aspect of who he was?
She knew, and we believe her father-in-law knew, too. He had to have known. But, you know, well, like when Jesse purchased the 160 acres from his father-in-law, he purchased it in gold. And back in those days, especially Reconstruction era, you know, Texas and the South, nobody had gold except for, you know, rich people, you know, the carpetbaggers that would come from the North and buy up land and all that and then make a profit. It was rare for anybody to have gold. Jesse had gold, and it was, well, he was, Thomas Hudson Barron had also had, some of his sons had ridden with other groups during the war, and I think that was where they probably, I guess, had a bond. If, you know,
I think it's like an underground network that's formed. I think word gets out kind of like in every era of, you know, great tribulations. I think people form underground networks where the communications begin. And I think it was just kind of like that for them. And, you know, they had like an underground network of loyal supporters, people who would help them come to them. I think people would, when they needed something, there were followers there to help them.
Now let's talk about this shift in his life. I mean, is he committing crimes all through this time? Is he going into hiatus at points where there's a year or two that the great Jesse James is not out committing crimes? What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, he would. Well, he kept up with the robberies, but he would go on long periods where he didn't. We've got his diary from 1871 until 1876. And there were years like, I think it was 1873. He didn't mention anything. 1875, there was nothing. And in some years it would be, you know, half the year and then the rest went dark. But he would, you know, in his diary, for example, he even signed his name, J. James, and also his initials, J.W.J. And there were, the diary itself is littered with fellow, known gang members like Bill Wilkerson and others. But he kept robbing, but over the years, and he wanted out the entire time. He wanted a peaceful life. He just didn't, he didn't want to turn himself in because he probably would have been hung or killed. And you know, he'd already tried to turn himself in at the end of the war and was almost killed, so he didn't want to do that again. So I think he took his cousin's name, James L. Courtney, and used that name as his alias, and it worked great here in Texas. A lot of the guerrillas that lived around him, and it was in a current-day Falls County, Texas. And it used to be called Buttermilk, Texas. Now it's called Blevins, Texas. It's just a little dot on the map about 30 miles south of Waco. But that's where a lot of guerrillas that he had fought with during the war were in that area, and sometimes some of the guerrillas would go on robberies with him.
So he really has an amazing network that he's put together. So you follow these diaries, and I guess I've got to, you know, it shows the other side of who this man is, that he kept journals about his life, that he wasn't just this merciless killer, this man without a land. He was sharing his stories. Would he show remorse or regret if there was a shooting or a death that took place by his hands?
He never talked about his feelings. It was more of a journal than we call it the diary. It's more of a journal. You know, it's like today I did this. I went to town and bought supplies. He listed each supply he would buy and how much it cost. And then, you know, he never talked about, oh, I felt bad about this or that. Like, for one example that it seemed strange, there was a guy named Dave, and I think they were breaking wild horses, and all he wrote was, Dave broke his neck. And, you know, that was the end. I thought, God, no, oh, you know, that was a horrible thing happened today. Dave broke his neck. It was just flat out, just cut and dry. Dave broke his neck.
He would show, I think, sometimes paranoia, though. I think when you live the kind of life he lived as Jesse James, that carries over. No, I don't think you can ever truly escape that life. And sometimes in his journal, he would mention he seemed guarded and kind of paranoid when new people would come out to his property. He would put examples like so-and-so showed up today and they said their names were so-and-so, or so they said. And that seemed to be a pattern throughout his journal. So I think there were I think he had some, you know, paranoia. Like he didn't truly trust that they were really who they said they were. So he did show, you know, some emotion and questioning of people's identities.
That's true.
All right. Does he, you know, as his life is moving on and he's approaching, what age was he finally reportedly shot and killed?
They said he was shot. Well, the alleged death happened in April 2nd, 1882. And, you know, it was supposedly in the morning, and Bob and Charlie Ford had supposedly shot him in the back of the head. And, you know, he was, and that's where, you know, the historical account, that's where we really found a lot of discrepancies in most of the stories surrounding the alleged death of Jesse James. It was really interesting. But I also wanted to mention one other thing in the diary real quick. One of the trips they went on, it was a trip that he and the boys went on. And they went to Shreveport, Louisiana, caught a steamship south to Natchitoches, Louisiana, got off the steamship, crossed over into the Louisiana side, and took a road heading back up north, the opposite direction they just came on the steamship. Everywhere they went on this trip, there were robberies in their area. And they stopped at a man's house who was named G. Fontenot. It was Gervais Fontenot. And I thought, I'd like to know more about this guy. Why did they choose his place to stay the night? And I started researching Gervais Fontenot, found out shortly that he was a retired U.S. Marshal. And I thought, that's strange that they would stay at a retired U.S. Marshal's home. But at the same time, his father-in-law was a former Texas Ranger, so it wasn't too strange. I thought, well, you know, back in those days, it took out a lot of outlaws and lawmen they were the same. A lot of lawmen were also outlaws. You know, they'd just hop the fence and rustle some cattle or do something to, I guess, make ends meet. But I checked out Gervais Fontenot deeper, did his family tree, and found out he was the nephew of Jean Lafitte, the famous pirate.
No kidding.
And that kind of ties in with what my sister had said earlier about this network. They had a network of, it wasn't just guys out robbing banks and trains and they didn't know anybody. They had a really deep network of people. I mean, ties with, you know, and he didn't know Lafitte personally, but it was Lafitte's nephew he was staying the night with in Louisiana.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
So, talk to me about his reported last days. What led to him being shot in the head? And did the Ford brothers, did they know who they had or who they believed they had?
We think the Ford brothers wanted to help Jesse, but they also wanted the money, the reward money for killing Jesse. We think it was Wood Height who was killed and not Jesse. But, you know, leading up to that,
we'll get into that in a few minutes. Yeah, I want to just address this point, you know, for what history believes.
OK,
what led to these last few moments in the life of Jesse James and ending up being shot in the back?
OK, according to history, the historical account, you know, after the end of the James gang, the primary gang after the failed bank robbery in Northfield, Minnesota, Jesse wanted to build a new gang. And, you know, some of the younger brothers after Northfield, they were all in prison now. And it was just Jesse and Frank. And that Jesse wanted to build a new gang. It was said that Frank wanted out, and he didn't. He just wanted out. He was probably getting old. He'd been shot up, especially after the robbery in Northfield. He wanted out. Jesse needed a new gang, didn't want to quit. And he formed this new gang, which included Bob and Charlie Ford and Dick Liddell and a couple of other people were involved. But most of them were new guys, inexperienced. They pulled off a few robberies here and there. They didn't get much. People talked, like Dick Liddell was said to have been, you know, several gang members were captured and they talked. And that just started, the noose was tightening around Jesse. So Bob and Charlie Ford supposedly cut a deal with the governor of Missouri, Governor Crittenden. And that night in, you know, early April, or that morning, early one morning in April, they saw their chance. Jesse, who was a paranoid man, stood up on a chair to dust a sampler in the room, and they shot him in the back of the head and promptly turned themselves into the law in St. Joseph, Missouri. And that was basically the end of Jesse, according to history.
So with this death, you know, what exactly happens now, Teresa? I mean, does this get reported? Do they collect on this bounty for Jesse James? Kind of walk me through what history believes at this point, not what you guys are about to share with us.
So they once the news broke out that Jesse James was purportedly shot, you know, chaos erupted in St. Joseph, Missouri. That's where he was supposedly living at the time. Of course, you know, it was lots of confusion, lots of doubt, because he had purportedly did an assassination attempt once before in 1879. So there were doubts. Yeah, a lot of people didn't believe it was Jesse James that when they said that he was shot and killed. Of course, Bob and Charlie were, you know, questioned about this. They were locked up and questioned. They basically had to do an inquest. His mother came in, Jesse James's mother, and at first said that wasn't her son. And then they took him out. Some people let her out, and when she came back in, she's like, oh, that is my son. So there was just lots of weird things that happened around that assassination, the purported assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah. And then, you know, after, well, like Teresa had mentioned, their mother, Zerelda, they got her from Clay County, took her up to St. Joseph to identify the body. She walked in and said, gentlemen, you are mistaken. That is not my son. And she was led out of the house. One of the women there led her out of the house, walked her back in, and when she came in, she was cursing everybody for killing her poor boy. Then, you know, they lined up people to try to identify him. A lot of people didn't believe it was him. Most people didn't know who to believe. And they got a few people to come up, former gang members and guys who fought with him in the Civil War. And they identified him as Jesse. The next few days, they had the coroner inquest, and then they buried him several days later at the James Farm.
He is right. So, you know, who's really responsible for this? Do you believe now, if we're now going to take a step outside of what history is believed, and Jesse James was not shot, was this something orchestrated by Jesse? Did they find a patsy to kill? So that, you know, because this is starting to sound more and more like Billy the Kid's story as well, with Pat Garrett and the fact that Billy the Kid may have survived his assassination.
I agree. And I don't believe Jesse orchestrated it. I think in this case, and he tried to orchestrate it in 1879 when his fellow gang member George Shepherd claimed he shot Jesse in the back of the head and he wanted the reward. And they sent a body out sent a posse out to search for a body. They couldn't find one. So that attempt didn't work. This time, there was a body. It wasn't planned for, but they took advantage of it.
And we think it was his cousin, Wood Heights. Because his cousin, at the same time, his cousin, Wood Heights, his body was conveniently found around the time that Jesse James was purportedly shot and killed, which is very weird.
One of the there's so many strange accounts around that. Nothing adds up when you really dig into the inquest and all the characters involved in it. For example, his first cousin, Wood Heights, who had been part of the gang, bore a strong resemblance to Jesse, it said. He was having a love triangle with Bob and Charlie Ford, a love affair with Bob and Charlie Ford's sister, Martha Bolton. Well, Martha was also, there were so many different, I don't know if she was having an affair with her farmhand also, Jim Gibson was his name, but there was a fight between Wood and Jim. Charlie and Bob were there. We don't know exactly who all was involved in the gunfight, but Jim and Wood were both killed during that fight. It's said that Jim was never found. He just disappeared from history after that. He was dead and buried somewhere, but Wood Height was killed. But historians can't agree exactly when he was killed. Some say he was killed in December of 1881. Others claim he was killed just a few days or the week before the alleged assassination of Jesse. And we tend to believe it was the latter. You know, he was killed in late March. But they supposedly found the body of Wood right when Jesse was allegedly killed. They display Jesse's body. Why didn't they display Wood Heights? There's no picture of him, historical pictures of him. We think the guy in the coffin is actually Wood Height, and that's the photo of him, but he was passed off as Jesse.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you believe that this was Jesse's way out? Did Jesse see this, or did he exploit that they thought they killed Jesse James, and he just went into quiet life after that point?
Yeah, I think I personally believe that when he took that as the opportunity when his cousin was murdered, to perfect time to take that opportunity and go with it and live out a life under a different alias.
Yeah, because he'd already had his alias. He was living in Texas under James L. Courtney, and he'd already had the perfect life carved out, and this was his chance to end his real identity as Jesse James.
Well, now that's all good and fine, right? This concept of maybe he did, and there's enough variants, enough maybes out there. What do we know definitively? And was he in on it with his own murderer?
I don't believe he was in on it with Bob and Charlie Ford. I think Bob and Charlie Ford knew Jesse. They knew Wood. They knew about the, they were there when Wood Height was killed at their sister's house. So they were the first to know of the death, or the first gang members to know of the death. So they probably contacted George Shepherd or any of the other older gang members in that area. And because Jesse was in Texas when that happened. So they contacted George Shepherd or one of the other gang members, and it went from there. And, everybody knew Jesse wanted out, and that was the opportunity. So all the Ford brothers had to do was say, yeah, we killed Jesse. That's Jesse. And then, some of the other people who identified the body as Jesse, it was just a couple of former gang members and guys who fought with him in the Civil War. They all knew him, they were close to him, and they weren't going to betray him. If they had betrayed him, Frank or any number of the other guerrilla or gang members may have killed him. So, whether it was loyalty or fear or a mix of both, the few people who could identify him went along with it. But the fact, the definitive facts come later. And I'm sure you'll get to that later, the exhumation and things like that.
Start to dive into that. Now, what's really interesting is that in the last 2 years, there was a special about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, proving pretty definitively that they did survive their encounter in Bolivia.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And there was a really, really interesting special about this. That's pretty conclusive. There's many that believe that that Billy the Kid survived. There were a few people through time that appeared to claim to be Billy the Kid. And, their stories have been pretty interesting in that they seem to know some inside information that nobody else should know. But then there are other aspects. Like, I know Brushy Billy was one of the most famous, and who they feature at the beginning of the Young Guns 2 movie, telling the story of his survival past his assassination. But that Brushy Billy, through science, they could tell that looking at a picture of Billy the Kid and looking at a picture of Brushy Billy, the ears do not connect the same way. And that's a telltale fingerprint to say that, this is not the same person. There are little telltale signs that have come up that they can analyze, measurements between eyes, measurements with the ears, and specifics of the way the ear lobes attach to the head, that will tell you if this is facial recognition, the right person. But here's another legend that supposedly survived his death. And now Jesse James surviving his death, reportedly. Mm-hmm. Let's start to build on that now. Do you have journals in your family that he continued to write after his assassination?
There are journals. We don't have those. Some of the other family members have them. They won't let anybody see those journals until I think they're waiting. I don't know why they don't. One guy has a few. Then we had another relative who was Jesse's granddaughter. She burned over 200 letters that he had and other items he had. She just burned them because she was ashamed of being related to an outlaw. And that was, I hate that she did that. It was destroying history. I can see her being ashamed because the older generation, that wasn't something you'd walk around and claim to anybody. You just kept that to yourself because it wasn't something to be looked up to in their minds. So I can kind of just trying to be empathetic and see things through her eyes. I can kind of understand it, but she shouldn't have burned the letters. It's irritating for us. But like you were talking about the ears not matching on some things, like with Brushy Bill and Billy. And that's true. The forensics people we've talked to in the past have pointed out, like, the top half of your ear is just as good as a fingerprint. And like our mother took our known family photographs to the Department of Public Safety here in Texas, which is our state police. They verified at their forensics lab, they verified that our family photos match Jesse and several of his family members, like his mother, same lady, same missing arm, same pattern on her dress, everything. They were the same people. Jesse, our photos, our great-great-grandfather, his photos match Jesse's. Then she took them to the Austin Police Department forensics lab, and they verified the same thing. And she wanted a third opinion. She got it from Visionics in New Jersey. And at the time, they were world leaders in facial recognition technology. They sold their programs to the military and international airports and stuff. They verified the same thing, that our family photos and several of the other photos we had matched Jesse and his family members. So we had that to go
there you
on.
Go. All right. So you've got forensic analysis. Unfortunately, you have none of the writings. Do you have any letters that he did send to other family members or any other tips that prove to you that you believe this shows he was still alive? And obviously photographs are pretty, pretty powerful, but what else do you have?
Well, we've got, all the known gang members in his diary. His handwriting matched a handwriting expert that our mother contacted, matched his handwriting, from the diaries to known historically accepted handwriting that was said to have been Jesse's. She said they matched. It was the same guy who wrote them. So we had handwriting analysis. We had the forensic, you know, the forensic photographic analysis. And then there was, and here's the thing, in 1995, the James Farman Museum in Missouri wanted to exhume the grave of Jesse, the alleged grave of Jesse, and prove once and for all that the historical story was accurate. So, and this gets real deep on this, but I'll try to, they hired a guy, the guy they hired to head this exhumation was Professor James E. Stars from George Washington University, but he was a law professor. He had no formal training as a forensics expert. And you'd think of with something of that nature, you'd hire a forensics, you know, a forensic anthropologist or anybody in that field of work to do the exhumation and do that type of work, not a law professor. Well, people asked him, well, why? Well, first of all, he dug up the grave, made a big show out of it. The county commissioner and the Clay County Parks director both, the commissioner, for example, was quoted as saying it was a tawdry sideshow the way they ran it and did all this. They dug up the grave. There was a woman's skeleton and a man's skeleton in the grave, which goes against historical accounts. The casket they dug up was wood, which didn't match the historical account of the casket Jesse was buried in, which was metal. And I mean, there were a lot of discrepancies. They couldn't get any DNA from the grave, but the James farm had some bones in a Tupperware bowl they had saved. See, in 1902, Jesse's grave was said to have been exhumed from the family farm and moved to the cemetery a few miles away from their farm in town. So they moved it in 1902. In 1978, the curator of the James Farman Museum dug up sections around the original grave and found a dog's tooth, a hog's tooth, several animal bones, and a human tooth. Put them in a Tupperware bowl and saved them. And it could have been anybody's tooth. But they kept that in the bowl and said that was Jesse's tooth. So James Stars, because he couldn't get anything out of the grave he dug up that had two skeletons in it, he got a court order to get the tooth and a sample of hair they had that was said to have been Jesse's hair. The Clay County commissioner had possession of that he was representing the James farm on that side of it. He had possession of the hair and the tooth. So they ordered him hand over the hair and the tooth. He said it was a tawdry sideshow. He didn't like it the way it was being run. He told my mother and I in person that it was the hair that he submitted, he pulled from his friend's head, who was the Clay County Parks director, John Hartman. It was John Hartman's hair that he submitted. And he said the tooth was of the same type of origin. He just didn't tell us where he got the tooth from. And he laughed the whole time. It was real funny to him. He couldn't stand anybody involved with the exhumation. So he didn't like the way it was being done. So he handed in a fake hair and fake tooth. And when they tested it at the lab, they said, we've been proven right. The DNA matches, you know, a known family member. There, that's a whole nother thing. The guy they tested the DNA against, alleged DNA, was Robert Jackson out of Oklahoma. And his, you know, they acted like he was a direct descent from the James family, had the same mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down through the female line. And they said he matched. Well, if you check his genealogy, it is highly questionable. And we don't believe he is a descendant of the James family. And the whole thing, it gets really confused and convoluted. There's all these people who you know, like having a lawyer. Oh, and another thing, they asked him why he didn't exhume Jesse's mother and just test the DNA right there with the mitochondrial DNA of his mother versus the DNA they thought they had. And the lawyer, James Stars, said the Missouri law prevented them from doing that because she didn't die under under suspicious circumstances. We checked the law. There is no such law in Missouri. We even contacted the Attorney General of Missouri, and he said there's no such law. And later, James Stars admitted that he basically, he said he embellished on that part of it. And I thought, why would you? Why would you lie to people? Right. It's just a nice word, way of saying he lied.
If he embellished on that, what other things have been lied? Right.
And here's the thing. The other thing I wanted to get out is they had a known descendant of the James family, right down a straight female line from Zerelda down to this lady. Her name was Sue Laura Hill. She lived in California. Everybody knew about her. The James farm knew about her. Everybody involved knew about her. Why didn't they test her DNA? I mean, nobody had any disagreements on her. They didn't even contact her. So mom contacted her after, it was in the late 90s. She contacted her and asked if she could have a sample of her DNA. She went to her doctor. He took the sample, submitted it under strict chain of custody, and sent it to a DNA doctor here in Texas that we've been using. He compared mom's DNA to Sue Laura Hill's DNA and showed there was a definite relationship. He said, he laid out, we need to test the DNA every step up from, my mom, her father, his mother, to Jesse. And then, test it against Sue Laura Hill's, just so there would be no question at all on whether or not we were directly descended or just related. I feel almost out of breath.
That's great. That's overwhelming amount of information and supporting corroborative evidence to your claims on this. Do you believe that history is ready to accept the fact that Jesse James survived that? And at what age do you believe that Jesse James really did die, in what year?
We believe he died at the age of 97 in 1943 in Blevins, Texas.
Wow.
And that
so he lived out a full life.
Yeah, 97 years old. And he died in Marlin, Texas, at a place that was called the Bowie Clinic at the time. It no longer exists. But yeah, he died in Marlin, Texas, at Falls County, Texas.
What leads you to that door?
To the Bowie Clinic?
To that ending of his life, yes. Oh, everybody else has kept their files and letters and destroyed history, what do you have that brings you to this point? I know that's what our listeners will be most fascinated by.
Well, we've got the diaries. We've got some of his possessions. We've got the photos. We have.
I wanted to get out, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, Danny, but it's kind of important to get out. We do have one of his journals that has his signature J. James in it. And it's in his handwriting. And to me, that's some of the biggest evidence. Why would he have J. James's signature in his diary, in his handwriting? It's little things like that. That's just one of the pieces of evidence we have that points to that he could be Jesse James.
Yeah, when we first started looking, it's like, why would he sign his name J. James? Why would he sign his initials JWJ on another page? Why did he have ciphers and coded messages that you have to figure out in his diary? I mean, it took a while to figure out what basically coded writing in his diary.
We have a treasure map. There was just lots of evidence that the assumed name that he took, Courtney, there were Courtneys that were related to the James family. For example, one source says that when the purported fake death took place, there were two Courtney boys who led the funeral procession when they were going to bury the body. So there's Courtneys all throughout, mixed in with the Jameses throughout the throughout history.
The photo you found, Teresa found a photo of Jesse at his own funeral. Our great-great-grandfather standing with Jesse's mother, looking at the guy in the casket, who we believe matches up very well with Wood Height.
Doesn't that seem insane, though, to be that cavalier to show up?
I think it's his MO. He was bold. That's why he stood out with the you know, in history, because he was bold and daring. And to me, that was his MO to show up, I think.
And it was, you know, nobody else knew what he looked like. So it was actually a lot safer than you would think. Yeah, at first thought, it seems like, wow, you know, you'd think he would have stayed in Texas and until it all blew over. But at the same time, nobody else could identify him except his family and gang members.
All right. He makes it through to this life to the 40s, dies at a very rich old age. And really, I mean, that is, you know, now it's a few generations ago now, that's how close Jesse James survived his tumultuous lifestyle. Now you're being the great, great grandchildren of this. What does the family legend and lore say? I mean, obviously he survived, you know, to a pretty decent age for his legend anyway. But, you know, do other family members buy into this, or do they feel that this is, you know, just a pipe dream?
Yeah, they believe it. There was a part of our family, and they weren't the immediate family members. They were some of our cousins, and they fought us tooth and nail on it. They didn't want it out. And there's a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of theories on why they did that, but like May, for example, one of the cousins, she had burned over 200 of his letters just because she was ashamed of it. They were also hiding things, and there's a lot of different reasons. I think some of it dealt with some of his treasures that he had had. That side of the family who fought us tooth and nail, their parents were, you know, Jesse's children. And they were the ones that during his funeral, when he died in 1943, half his children stayed at his house digging up the yard looking for gold and silver. So, you know, it's a lot of infighting on that side of the family. And I think a lot of it dealt with greed. And in other cases, some of them just didn't want people knowing they descended from Jesse James.
Now you mentioned earlier that you have a treasure map, and if I don't jump back to that, my listener base is going to beat me senseless. So you found a treasure map for what? And have you ever gone to see if there's anything left behind?
It was one of my mom's aunt passed it down to her. At the time, my mom was really wanting to get into this, and you know, she heard the stories her entire life, and she decided she wanted to finally just, when she started researching, she wanted to, you know, find out if it was true or not. She wanted to find evidence to back it up. And her aunt passed down the map to my mom and said, you know, this was her quote. She said, you know, he was Jesse James, right? That's what the aunt told her. And then she provided her with the treasure map. And it was interesting because there was also a Bonnie and Clyde article clipped on that map. And we don't know why that article was attached to the map. So that kind of leads us down another rabbit hole.
Well, the other part about Bonnie and Clyde and, you know, their article and about Bonnie and Clyde being included with the map, it's interesting. Bonnie's maternal grandfather he owned the farm directly next door to our great great grandfather, Jesse.
Wow.
It's a proven fact. And it ties in, that goes back to the strange connections. Like, why did he stay at Jean Lafitte's nephew's house? And then why did, you know, it's just weird. It's almost like a connection of all these people. Did they gravitate towards one another? I don't know. Or was it part of a network?
Yeah. And we believe it was part of a network.
Fascinating yeah. Stories. This is a great book. And listen, folks, even with what we've covered today, it's still not even scratching the full surface and depth of this story.
Exactly.
Get the book. Get the book, The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James, based on family records, forensic evidence, and his personal journals. If you love mysteries as much as I do, and a look back at history through a fresh pair of eyes, pick up this book, check it out for yourself, and then write to us. Let Tim and I know what you think of it once you've had a chance to read it. Make sure that you rate and review the book as well. Daniel, Teresa, it has been a real pleasure speaking with you. Is there any other last bits of information you want to leave us with before we part ways?
First of all, I'd like to say thanks for having us. It was a great pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Great.
I enjoy talking and looking at a different aspect of life and crime. And you know, people always wonder, how do people get pushed into this? How do they get to this point? And it's interesting to hear a backstory to what actually occurred.
Yeah. And also, I wanted to thank you again for having us. We could talk the whole day and still barely scratch the surface on a lot of it. You can, you know, find the book at Inner Traditions, our publisher, innertraditions.com, or anywhere books are sold. It's The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James. And in my first book, which deals with Jesse's treasures and their connections to, people in antiquity, it's Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, which came out last year, and it's a wild story, and it's all verifiable and true, and it just blows your mind. The deeper we dig, the more amazing things we find, and it's hard to believe until you find the facts that pin it all down, and everything's verifiable.
Exciting stuff. Daniel, thank you again for joining us, Teresa. It's been a pleasure. And
thank you so much.
Let us know what doors this new book opens for you, what you uncover. Yeah. Because it'd be fascinating to hear who might come forward with more information now that you've made this even more public.
That's true. And that's usually how it works. We come out with some information, and there's always somebody out there who's got a piece of the puzzle that we would love to hear about.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Well, we've got the book and the link on today's episode. Make sure you pick that up. So thank you again for tuning in, being a part of the program. We'll be back with you this weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. You can find more information on all of my projects, all of our radio shows, and everything that Tim and I are up to by visiting darknessradio.com. And don't forget to order our guest's book off of today's episode. You'll find the link right there. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday.